Welcome to SFH Presents, the One and a Third podcast with your host, Zach Polk.
I like that too, but I do like, you know, animation titties. Oh, that everyone has someone in their life that deals with the shit that I deal with.
And featuring Tyler Southern.
You want me to rub your feet? You want me to get the bath running? Something? Can I help you relax?
Now turn that shit up.
Just a reminder, we are not medical professionals. This is for entertainment purposes only. So if you're having a real issue, contact a doctor. There's plenty of helplines, even a relative, whatever is necessary to get you help. Today on the podcast, we've got my stage wife. Or am I? Are you the wife? Or am I the wife? I don't know.
Well, Joe Bachman. That's
what's true. Up, what's going on, Joe?
Not a guys. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, man.
Excited to have you, brother.
Yeah, we've been looking forward to this one for a while. In fact, last episode, the girl that we had on, she dealt with some sensory overload issues, pretty severe as well. And she had put this little strip of like sandpaper on the back of her phone. So when she was in a rough situation, she could have her phone in her hand and she would rub that to like center herself or whatever. And I said, man, we need to tell Bachman about that, because you know he's not listening to this shit. Nope, there it is, the first 2 minutes. Go ahead.
I was just reading an article last night because it was talking about how some younger kids with sensory disorders love drawing on walls, coloring on walls specifically.
Yeah.
And it had 100 times more to do with the texture than it had to do with anything else. So the way that a lot of therapists are countering that is they're taking a piece of sandpaper and putting it on an easel and then putting the paper in front of the sandpaper and allowing the kids to color on that. And that has been a game changer. So it's so crazy that you started with that. So I just read that 7 hours ago.
That makes me curious if, you know, how many kids that can't express that, you know, the color on walls can't express that they have sensory overload issues and, you know, are drawn to
just mad,
completely misunderstood, which I would say is a good point to make right out the gate. You know, I feel like as much as I've learned from you about your sensory overload issues, I feel like that it is very misunderstood and it makes you misunderstood.
But I don't think that's any different than anybody with mental health issues, right? Because I started to learn more about myself because of how much you taught me about you when I dove into you.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, getting to work with you every day and us becoming close as any two men can be, I was constantly battling between, God, when he does this, it pisses me off. And then you coming back, and when we sat down as close as we are as friends and said, I don't want to be mad at you. I want to understand you.
Yeah.
And that's something that you and I have done with everything. And so after countless hours learning about depression that you dealt with, I dove deeper into myself so that I could explain myself to you.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense. And
It makes perfectly good sense.
Tell me if I'm wrong, but it brought you and I closer because 100%. We understood each other so much better.
Well, not only that, but for me, it just, you know, I don't think that it's that abnormal to kind of take things for granted or get caught up in your own thinking. And as far as like dealing with what I was dealing with, not many people, if anyone, had put as much effort in my life as you did to understanding it and accepting some of the things that were that resulted because of it. And whenever you went to like talking about your things and I started to learn about that, I thought that it was important for me to spend as much time trying to learn about it and understand it, which softened me about a lot of things in the same way. But it also opened me up to thinking about that with other people. It made me more aware of other people dealing with shit where sometimes I felt like I got caught up in my own issue where I wasn't as patient with other people where I expected them to be patient with me. Does that make sense?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah.
Which, yeah, which
even
I
with
feel...
Ty.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, even with Ty, almost a couple years or a few years after Ty and I met, we started diving into the world of autism, and all of this is on the spectrum. And it's the same thing with him. You know, I've gone through years of learning about so many of the things that I've struggled with. I still, as recently as this past week, I still wonder, I don't know the answer to this question, but I still wonder how much of it is genetic, how much of it is taught. That's the biggest thing in the world for me, because No, jump in, Ty. I want to hear.
No, so the everyone always, you know, they're putting something in the food. There's something in this. It's the vaccinations. It's all these things, because there's so much. There's so many more people diagnosed than there ever were. And I'm like, because in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, they tried to beat it out of their kids. They just thought the kid was a lazy bum, or or only confrontational and just didn't want to get along, or just dumb. Mentally retarded was the term. But just now there's a better understanding of what all's going on. Therefore, the diagnoses would obviously ramp up, because people are actually getting their kids checked rather than trying to straitjacket it out of them.
Well, even in the 90s and early 2000s, the way they resolved a lot of things like that was just shoving Ritalin down a kid's throat, because
every medication they can think of.
Right. He's having a hard time paying attention in school. And it's like, well, because school sucks, you're not challenging him. And he's dealing with a whole litany of issues that who know if they came from his, again, it's a perfect question. How much of it is actually genetic, and how much of it is a learned behavior or something? Because I've definitely heard that so much of who we are is shaped before you're 4 years old, which is insane.
Mm-hmm. And I just...
Zach, like everything else that you and I talk about, there's two sides to both of this. There's three sides, right? There's his, hers, and in the middle. And when you talk about what Tyler just said, I think you're absolutely right, T. I think that there's so much more of awareness of the diagnosis. But I also think the flip side is equally as important. Our food industry doesn't give a flying fuck about what they put in our foods. They have no concern for health, and our health industry has no concern for foods, and vice versa. And that goes with everything else that you talked about. It goes with vaccines. There's so many different angles of this. And to jump back where we started with respect to whether it's learned or whether it's genetic, there's also one more really, really important thing that no one talks about, which I will admit for myself has been the hardest part of all of this. I was raised by a military man. I was raised by a man that absolutely positively believed in the man gets shit done. The man hides the feelings. The man does what needs to be done for everyone else. Mm-hmm. And the rest of it is swallowed. And I lived my life that way. And not only did I live my life that way, I lived my life with the intention of raising my children that way. Mm-hmm. And the more that I've taken the time to learn about the things that do occur with every one of these people, that's causing more mental health issues than it is fixing anything. And so I think that's the caveat. That's the third part about this that no one wants to talk about. I still to this day have countless friends that I would consider closest in my life that are 100% never going to have this conversation. Never. Yeah. Just not going to happen.
Well, I live with one right now. I mean,
so it ended up being cultural would probably be the other word then.
There you go. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was raised, I joke about it with my mom every day, but I was raised when you see people vacuum their carpets and you get those lines in the vacuum, lines in the carpet. I was raised every day that my mom and dad came home from work, there better be lines in my carpet. My house better be spotless. My brother's homework better be done. The house better, like that's, I was military. So now at 50 years old, I get unbelievable pleasure and calmness out of lines in the carpet. You can't tell me that wasn't learned.
Mm-hmm. Well, you looked at my movies, you were big mad that they weren't color coordinated, even though they were alphabetical.
I know. And here's the funniest part about it. When I walk into my own home, if there's kids' toys on the carpet, my brain is exploding. But Tyler, when I walk into your house and I see the room of quote disaster, it gives me a sense of warmth. It gives me a sense of it's lived in. There's love here. Yeah. There's kids here. It should be like this. Mentally, why do those two things not equate? Like, yeah. Why can't I walk into my own home and feel that way?
That's fascinating. I don't know. I remember when I stayed with you guys in Oviedo, I was like, man.
You know how it is?
It was like a show house, dude. It was so clean and everything was in place. It was almost uncomfortable. You know,
I don't take offense to that because it's uncomfortable for me.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I just put a post on this the other day about Facebook. A stupid throw blanket right there. Right there on my couch, right? A stupid throw blanket. If I walk into anyone else's home and the blanket's just thrown across the couch, once again, to me, it's loved, it's warmth, it's lived in. In my own home, it's like, why does my wife and my two children hate me? Why do they want to be messy?
Yeah.
So I still have that whenever I'm going to have company over.
Okay.
And I don't know if that started with my mother, or I actually think it started with how my mother acted whenever we had the same situation where the house had to be clean, not as far as vacuumed every day. She had three boys and, you know, dad was doing his thing. So she wasn't going to fight us on that. But whenever someone would be coming over, it was clean this, do that, clean up your room, even like in case they go in there kind of thing. So, which again, I get that. But now, when I'm going to have people or someone come over for any reason, I'm just like the kitchen that I was just chilling in and, you know, having my coffee and feeling good. I'm like, oh, what is that? That. Like, I've got to move all this and put that away, put this in the kids' room, wipe all this down. Like, so that at least it looks like an effort was made.
So how much of that,
I'm backing off a little bit.
How much of that do you think stems from the, you know, especially with you, well, both of you, I suppose, stems from the need for approval from others because of needing your parents to approve of the
thing? I'm offended that you just brought that up. That was very rude to call me out like that in front of everybody with no warning.
I think it's a combination of both, man. I think it's a combination of, it gave me a sense of I'm not going to get in trouble by my parents. So that still resonates today. Like, everything's where it's supposed to be. But as I grew into a young adult, and certainly through the last 25 years, it's more of my mind is clearer and I can work better and think clearer when everything is in its place.
Makes sense.
You know that about me, Zach. I mean, I would show up, 2.5 hours before a show, tape down every cable, you know, it's
right.
Zach, you too, like every musician has their own, I don't know what you want to call it, but procedure.
Way of doing shit. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I know Zach, like he had to have his foot platform in a very certain spot, his microphone stand in a very certain spot. It gives us a sense of comfort, all of us, but mine's to the extreme. You know, and that's the part. Like, who else do you know in your life that dries their kitchen sink? Like, I dry it. I have to. I have to get a paper towel and make sure there's no water spots in my sink. It's a fucking sink. It should have water in it. But like, I know that.
You know what's funny? I feel like everyone has that same sense. It's a matter of how deep that meter is. You know what I mean? Like, because who doesn't work better when things are clean and organized and straight? Everyone, but some people like me, I'm a pretty disorganized person and it bothers me, but it doesn't bother me much. Do you know what I'm saying?
So by normal human standards, you're unorganized, or you know where everything is and it just doesn't look like people want it to look?
That's pretty accurate.
It's interesting.
That's pretty accurate. Really good question.
That's a whole guy thing. In that, like, there was a text meme or something, and it was, hey, I need a paperclip. And he responded, in the bedroom next to the leg of the dresser. And she took a picture of a paperclip literally sitting in the carpet next to the leg of the dresser. It was like, are you kidding me right now? And he's like, it's where it was.
I know where accurate. It's all
at. It may not be exactly where you think it should be, but I know where it's at, and it's where I need it to be. No, it's your space. Like, you can do it however the heck you want. I don't need to color code my movies to make anyone else happy. I'll just not bring him into this room anymore.
Even when somebody's not here for a while, I have like a platform on the other side. Like half my bed becomes some of my shit, and it looks horribly unorganized, but everything I need is right there. Yeah, there's something kind of strange about that I never really thought about. Yeah, I know where everything is. It just looks like shit.
Mm-hmm. Well, because I go back to my ex. She needed it. She's the reason it's called Type A. And just needed everything to be everywhere. And I was a problem if I did not help with that. And I always did my best to help with that. But now that I'm, you know, bacheloring it up, I'm always with the whole nothing's dirty, but cluttered is kind of how I do it anyways. Like, yeah, it's cluttered, but nothing's filthy. Like, if you start moving stuff, nothing's sticking to the damn counter.
Yeah.
So it, you know, pardon the mess, but we live here.
A great analogy for that, that you could have a hamper full of clean clothes that were just came out of the dryer. You might not put them away for a week, but they're not dirty.
They're not dirty. Did you see what I did earlier? Because there's literally a fresh basket of clean ass clothes sitting in the laundry hall.
And to go back to what Zach just said, that's a perfect example of the extremes, right? Because for me, if there was a basket of laundry that is clean, for me to even lie down in bed at night to try to go to sleep before that was put away is a joke in my own head.
I can just feel your brain start to itch and like your face start to melt and just, I'm going to go fold all the laundry. I don't care if it's 2 a.m. I have to run it in the dryer for another second to get the wrinkles out. And then I'm going to,
well, it would never make it that far. It would never make it till 2 a.m. I wouldn't lay down. And that's the thing, like procrastination for me is a form of extreme anxiety. If I procrastinate anything, work or personal, it's just not, you know, and it's like, perfect example. I stood up Saturday at like 7 o'clock at night. I got up, started getting dressed, put my shoes on, and Malazzi's like, "What are you doing?" And I'm like, "I'm taking the trash out. It's trash night." And she's like, "Trash night is Sunday still, Joe. You can't take it out 24 hours early as much as I know you want to." But that's the way my brain works. It's like so laser focused on what I can do to get done. And it's only because that's the only way I can mentally relax.
Wow. And I'm at the other. I don't think I've ever done a thing in my entire life that I didn't procrastinate first.
Oh, dude. I was going to say, if shit would stop working out really great every time I procrastinate, I'd probably procrastinate less. But because things keep coming out all rose colored and awesome, I continue to procrastinate.
Hey, Zach, do you remember when we played the Perky this year? Do you remember? I'm sorry, not this year. So last year, I don't remember. You weren't there this year, right? I just remember that.
Right.
Anyway, there's a female artist who's incredible, Megan Farrell. I don't know if you've ever heard her name. She's been on a few rock boats, and she played the Perky this year. Anyway, I've really fallen in love with her music, sweetheart of a human being. And she has very openly struggled with some mental health stuff. And we were on the phone the other day, and I said something about this whole I'm completely unable to procrastinate. And she said something that, God, dude, it hit home so hard and made me think of you. And she said, I'm only capable of procrastination because I know for a fact that I do my best work when I'm under the most pressure. So even though that pressure is self-created, I will purposely say, I'm not going to learn this song until Thursday. We're playing it on Friday. Because I know I'll learn it better on Thursday under that pressure.
Yeah.
And that hit me, dude. Because you've never explained it like that, but there's a lot of ways that you're like that.
It's 100%
true.
That's
me too.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to what you just said, where you said everything works out for you when you procrastinate. Where I can think of, you know, when it comes to like packing, say, for example, going to Mexico or when we're going to go somewhere for a while. I'm a last minute, like last minute packer, and I stress about it, but I've gotten to the point in the last few times where I'm like, every single time I've procrastinated this, and every single time I've packed everything I needed and had no problems whatsoever, why stress about it? Just accept that that's who you are. This is how you do it. And it's worked out. So she's right. That's pretty profound, though, to hear it in words. Well,
it is profound. And it also goes back to you and I taking the time to learn. Had I never heard it like that, to me, procrastination has always been a form of laziness, right? Which drives me crazy. But when I heard it explained like that, and I realized that it was more of a mental thing, like Brian Weiss and I joke all the time, if we're leaving from Mexico in October, we'll text each other in August and say we're packed. And like, that's just what I am. It's what I do. Like, if I could have four suitcases packed in advance for my next four trips, that's who I would be. So hearing somebody say to me, what's that?
No, I was just going to say, you're also the guy that hits his hotel room and puts all of his clothes in his drawer before he sits down. Which I tried. We were in Chicago when I came back from Mexico. We did a wedding up there with me and Torin Green. And I brought my daughter, my daughter's friend, and my son, and we all shared the same hotel room. So I'm like, hey, I'm going to Bachman this shit up. There's not a lot of space. Let me get all my clothes, put them in the drawer. And then I left all my clothes in the drawer, about $150 worth, and they called the hotel the next – yep. left my new Deftones shirt. I called the hotel. They're like, no, haven't seen hide nor hair of those things. And I'm like, fuck. I know you guys are wearing that shit.
Right.
Just walk in and some girls behind the counter wearing an oversized Deftones shirt.
Did you ever get any of it back?
No, none of it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Frustrating.
I'm with that on the packing for sure. I pack the day before. And if I have enough, like if we're not leaving ass cracker early, I'll do it in the morning. And then, so I spend the last day or the last window or whatever doing whatever laundry, because whatever I'm bringing to a trip, especially like Mexico, where I was there for 10 days, that's the longest trip I ever go on. I'm bringing most of the stuff I wear on the regular. So like if I didn't do laundry right away, something's dirty that I'd like to bring. So yeah, I end up having to wear some like Bobo shorts that I don't care for because I'm washing everything I'm going to bring. And then when I got a speech or some thing they need me to do at an event, I end up writing it or going off the cuff every time. Lance tells me that. I'm just like, bro, should I write something down? And like, no, because when you go off the cuff, it sounds natural and awesome. And I'm just like, oh, cool. Cause I'm always worried about that. But when I write shit down, I'm like worried I'm forgetting something, or, you know, even if I did bullet points, I'd still, I'll nail everything if I don't worry about writing it down.
Yeah. I'm definitely in the same headspace as far as like preparing for something.
That I completely get. If for lack of a better term, the artistic side, I totally get, because there's a very different deliverance of something that's pre-prepared and written versus something that's off the cuff. And I agree with that. But the first thing that you said gave me total anxiety when you're talking about, oh, if I have enough window, I'll pack the morning of and I'll do the laundry. I guess my question for you guys is, what about the what ifs? What about you wake up and there's an accident and therefore the road to the airport is an hour and a half longer? You wake up and your washer's not working. Like, these are all the things that come into my head. Like, if I don't procrastinate, then I don't have to deal with that. That's the way my brain works.
Well, I pad my trips pretty well as far as like timing, because as you know, I'm not late to things.
Never.
So I'm on time. I'm never like I'm super early, but. I always pad everything I do with extra time. Like when I'm supposed to leave, I pad it. So like to prepare for things like that. So even if I'm last minute packing, I pack for that padded time. Does that make sense?
Got it. Still. So yeah. Yeah.
I always, so, even in my procrastination, prepare for things like that a little bit.
Okay.
That's adult procrastination versus teenager procrastination. But so on how that works for me is, of the things that I procrastinate, traveling and or getting there is not one of them. I loathe being late for shit. I'll be an hour early before I'm on time. Like, same. If I'm on time, that's my dad in my ear 15 minutes early is on time, you know, on time is late. And, the military.
You see this military shit, Polk? This is what we do. This is what we do.
In the military, my service helped with that, obviously, because we had to be at the frickin', we had to be up at 2, at the armory at 3, pull rifles by 4, and then transpo wasn't getting there till 8. So it's just a bunch of hurry up and wait. But, like, I guess the kids are calling it FOMO these days. That's when my anxiety will start kicking in. I'm like, hey, you know how we're just sitting here and we've got a 30-minute drive to do? And people are like, yeah, and we don't got to be there for 2 hours. And I'm like, but if we were closer, it wouldn't be a problem. Like, I'm just ants in my pants. I'm like, we need to go. We need to go. And, yeah, I'll get us there, and I'll sit out in front of something for an hour. and that's the only thing that I'm like, nope, nope, fuck all y'all. Let's go. Like, we need to move. Why are you not in the car? Drive.
Yeah, I was always cutting that joke every time I got somewhere. Like, yeah, if you're not an hour early, you're 4 hours late or whatever. You know, just always making up numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that's
It's a quick way to find the veterans in the room.
My dad.
Or those raised by.
Yeah.
My dad was a Vietnam vet, but my dad was a hippie that was drafted. And my grandpa, well, this is really coming full circle. My grandpa was in a mine train accident, lost his legs above the knee, both of his legs. Actually, one was below the knee, but then had to have it's coming around right now. And
I was like, I hope you're not still talking. Your mic went out.
No. Anyway, my point is that didn't make my dad a military guy. Does that make sense? Like, he was still like a pot smoking hippie. He didn't gain any of that.
That was going to be my next question. Was, are you talking about your father or stepfather? Because you've called your stepfather your dad a few times, and I know that he was the one that was present most of your life and was awesome.
No, my dad was definitely not a part of my life. So that had something to do with it. But he also wasn't. I mean, he was an organized guy, but he was not he wouldn't line up with your dad's. You know what I'm saying? Like,
well, there has to be a difference between someone who is drafted and someone who chose to go on purpose. 100%. And mentally speaking, like, because I mean, my whole life the plan was military. Like, yeah. There wasn't a plan B or C. I was going to go in either the Marine Corps or the Navy and do something. And then at the very least do my 4 years and then go do whatever else. So college wasn't there. I didn't care. That wasn't something I was worried about. But yeah, if you had your whole life planned out and they were like, hey, this number came up on this day, so you've got to go for a year and fight bad guys you don't want to fight.
Right.
Like, I get when you come home, you're probably just going to be more jaded and disillusioned to all of that culture anyway. So you'd probably push harder and become more of a hippie and a pothead and whatever else.
Yeah, I think my dad making sense. I think he ended up pretty far from the front lines on a typewriter or something. So he used to,
that'd be the plan. Tuck me in a closet somewhere.
When my dad would hear a typewriter, he'd dive under a desk. It was wild. Yeah. Just to transition a little bit. So I know, you know, obviously we've talked so much. I know some of your past trauma. I think we all obviously have some. There's nothing that extreme that stands out to me. Even some of those trauma stories you told me from when you were quite young, something to do with a babysitter or a daycare that you stayed at. I don't want to say it wasn't a negative trauma because it kind of was, but kind of not, you know what I'm saying? Like, it wasn't,
I told you it wasn't, which is weird,
right?
Because it's supposed to be. And it's very possible that a shrink would say differently, right?
Right.
They could say, well, you don't see it as a negative, but these negative things affected you. For the listeners not in the know, I was quote unquote sexually molested in preschool, but not necessarily touched, if that makes any sense. Our preschool was ages five down to newborns, and the five-year-olds would have nap time upstairs, just the five-year-olds. And the teacher would have one of the younger teacher's aides, or in this case, her son, who was 18 or 19 at the time. And basically he would make the kids, myself included, he would make us do things to each other. So yes, at 5 years old, I was going down on a five-year-old girl, and vice versa, not having a remote clue of what that was or what it was supposed to be. And I have very vivid memories of it, but as I told you many times, like, he never touched us, or I shouldn't say that. It's not fair. He never touched me. I have no idea what went on other days, but I was never touched by an adult of any kind. And so looking back on it, I know it was wrong, but it never traumatized me, if that makes any sense at all.
In that time, it wasn't like you, I'm sure that you weren't like, oh my God, this is horrible. I can't believe he's making us do this. You know what I'm saying? Which I'm not.
No.
I'm not saying that to condone it, but I'm saying that to psychologically imagine myself in those shoes where you probably, because
of course,
I even remember like at that age messing around with a neighbor girl or whatever, where you're interested in that shit at an early age, just I think by instinct. You know what I'm saying?
Engaging in play.
Yeah.
Yep. It has absolutely affected my sexual kinks as an adult.
Yeah.
And anybody that's ever listened to Stern, they know that that's the norm. You know, if you're sexually abused and you, especially at that young of an age, there are things that become a kink to you. Right. So it has affected that, but I don't feel as though that stuff affected me negatively as much as, ironically, the stuff that we've already discussed. My childhood, I was raised more strict than any human being I've ever met in my life. Yeah. I was in bed by 8 p.m. my entire life up until high school, and including high school. If I got anything less than straight A's, I was punished for the entire quarter, the entire marking period. I would not be allowed back out. If my parents came home from work, both of them worked 9-to-5 jobs, the house was to be clean. My brother's homework was to be done, both of my brothers. Dinner was made most of the time. And it was very, very, very strict on so many levels.
Yeah,
that traumatized me. And I still have, I don't want to say nightmares, I just have a lot of negative pent-up emotion about the trauma that brought me through. And obviously, that's why I constantly question whether my OCD was inherited or learned or both. Right. Because there's clearly things that I learned that I still do.
So as far as, you know, you connecting that with your current sexuality, you are a self-proclaimed sex addict. You've said that
for sure. For sure.
Do you think it like lowered your inhibitions in regards to that at an early age, like made it so that wasn't almost in a good way, where I feel like for me, it wasn't like sex was a bad thing in my household, but it just wasn't talked about all that much. So it was something that I was almost like really, even to today, like not as free as I'd like to be about it. So do you think that made you more free and open about things because of dealing with that at such a young age?
I don't have anything to compare it to, so I don't know if it made me that way, but I can tell you that I've always had that mentality with everything. You know how much I preach about communication. You know how much I preach about none of these things that I preach about is my family. None of it. My family was not, like, my mother will be the first to tell you, she'll hold things in for 10 years. She doesn't talk about anything. You know, we never, ever, ever, my father and my mother, we never spoke about sex, ever, never. So part of it makes me wonder if it was me rebelling and doing the opposite. I don't know. I can't answer.
That makes some sense.
On the separate from that, did it affect your relationship with, trying to word it right, basically with sex in general, like when you were starting out, maybe not even teenage years, but like early 20s, when you started trying to potentially date more seriously, Were you ultimately more cavalier or just had more laissez-faire attitude about stuff and the girl didn't understand and you had to come to some sort of agreement?
Yeah, always.
Or, of course, grow on your own.
Yeah, I was just very open and honest from the very beginning of every relationship that I was in when it came to that type of thing. I was, hey, this is what I'm into. This is what I believe. This is what is very strong and important to me. And are you okay with that? That's the honest, you know, but I never held it in. I never pretended that I was something I wasn't. And there's no question that it pushed some away. And there's no question that it, you know, made a lot of them go, what?
Yeah.
but again, I don't know if this statistic is correct. I just heard it on Stern so many times, but it's 90% of porn stars were sexually abused at some form in their life. That's an outrageously high percentage if it's accurate.
That is.
And so.
No, you can go ahead.
Oh, Zach. No, you go ahead.
I was just going to say, how do you even, you can't necessarily say that. So let's say that they went through something similar to what you went through and it wasn't a traumatic experience per se. And it led to them being more open about their sexuality, which led to them being in porn. Is that necessarily a bad thing? You know what I'm saying?
No.
I think that society just looks at it
as a 9-to-5. So ultimately they're better off for it.
Well, I think
society. Here's the thing.
Go ahead.
Zach was going to say, go ahead. You say it. Cause that's what I was going to say.
Sorry.
You're the guest. You go for it. I want to hear your thoughts.
I think society holds sex in general to be very taboo and it's not something that people talk about at all. I've always been the opposite. I joke all the time, sex and pooping. Like we all do it, right? It's just something that people are raised as very taboo. Now, granted, I don't want to talk about pooping at the dinner table. I do, like, for me, there's a manners thing here. But like with sex, you would think on social media, you would think at, you know, Thanksgiving dinners and stuff, you would think sex didn't exist with family.
Yeah.
It's not something that people talk about. And I've always been very, very, very comfortable and open talking about it, maybe because it is such an important part of my life. And like you said, I don't look at it as a bad thing. I mean, it's a whole different podcast altogether, but I can get into all day long how, you know, I think prostitution should be legal and you know, it goes on and on. But I'm just very comfortable in my skin with what I love and what I like, and the people that know me know that. And that's never been an issue for me.
Well, at a minimum, I don't think sex workers should be looked down upon, like should be treated as if they're anything different or that they're damaged just because they went through something. Because I've known many. In fact, we had one on last week. But we can thank the Catholic Church for all of that, you know, the stigma around sexuality.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's literally something you have that you can barter. You two have sold a part of your body for most of your life. You've sang into a microphone. You've played on guitars. That's doing something with your body for money.
Yeah.
And why is using a different part of your body to get money a bad thing?
Well,
like, if everyone is on board and no one is being coerced or bamboozled or whatever, then how is it any of your business kind of thing?
Which, you know, you could go a step further than that. You can go pay for a massage right now. Someone can completely rub you down completely naked.
And only miss the erogenous zones.
Right. But don't touch the dirty, dark skin on my chest and don't touch the other fucking parts of my body that are private and dirty and naughty. Like, what the fuck, dude? Unless you find places Joe goes to where they do in the United States.
They don't upcharge you either. Yeah, but all joking aside, you could take it even one step further. Tyler can go out and say to Mary Lou, I want to pay you $100 to have sex with you tonight. That's against the law. Unless Tyler hires somebody to film it and pays Mary Lou then it's just porn.
Yeah, and like, it's legal.
That's not illegal. That's fucking insane is that?
So
that is
wild,
bananas. Man. On paper, that's straight up bananas.
I can't fuck Mary Lou for $100, but if somebody films it, and I pay her, then I can do it.
Yeah. And you can make that money back.
Yeah, so when you were talking about that, you brought up something else that I've always wanted to kind of bring up. Actually, I would like to bring up a lot. Go ahead.
Real quick, if we're going to change the subject, I have a quick question on the nursery school stuff. Did he ever get caught and or arrested and pay for his bullshit?
Craziest part about this is, man, the first time I spoke about that out loud, I was probably 20. And that person had passed already.
He died?
I have no... Yeah.
Yay! That's exciting. So
I have absolutely no idea if he was ever caught, if anybody ever came out. I certainly never said anything as a child.
He'd have been about my age, so died early. I'll take it.
No, dude, he was 18 when I was 5.
I'm not good at math, but still. So when you were 20, that's 15 years later.
Oh, I see what you're saying. 33, when he passed. Okay.
Yeah. I misunderstood. So 33-ish, 34-ish, which I'm 34. Hey, my math was right.
Woo! No, you were spot on. I thought you meant when the abuse stuff was happening. Sorry.
Oh, no, just the fact that his flame burnt out young, that makes my heart very happy.
Is smoke supposed to be pouring out of your ears, bro?
I don't know
what's going on right now.
I would say I hope it hurt too. I hope whatever it was wasn't slow or wasn't fast and painless. I hope it fucking sucked. Anyway, sorry. What were you going to ask?
That could be a whole podcast.
What was the subject change
too? No, I was just going to say, like, we were talking about, you know, in general, people not being able to talk about certain subjects, and it just kind of made me think about why you and I have such a great friendship and why we have such a great connection is just the constant brutal honesty. Just be saying what we feel, what's real, what right up front, putting it on the table, having a discussion, communicating. And I feel like it's so fucking normal in society for people just to put a face on the minute they leave the house and do that to their friends, their loved ones, their spouse, to everyone.
And just placate all day. Just how exhausting that has to be.
Unbelievable.
Just put on a persona. Yeah. And just placate everyone's feelings all day.
Yeah.
I'm just like, I'm going to be me. I won't be an asshole, but I'm going to be me unapologetically. And if you don't like it, we're not going to hang out. Like,
well, even if you're on the side of saying something negative, you know, quote unquote negative to someone, like that's how people improve and learn. Like, we've all watched the opening show, you know, the opening parts of American Idol when people came on singing who could not sing. Because nobody would tell them. No one in their life would be like, dude, you're horrific.
It's your passion. Go for it.
Right. No, you're great. You need to, you know, whatever. Even with the podcast, man, like I was telling Joe, like it's so strange because being a performer, I'm on a stage and I can see the people in front of me and everything that I do is reflected back to me, whether it's good or bad or how they react is instant. With a podcast, I put it out. And I see numbers, but that's it. Other than a handful of people that have said something, I have no idea what people feel. I have no idea if they're annoyed by me vaping. I have no idea if they're annoyed by that if they don't like the audio, the length of it, that I stammer on words or, you know,
lighting.
I'm like, right. I'm almost desperate for some critical, you know, feedback.
A comment section.
Some constructive criticism of like, hey, man, you know, this or that could be better if you did this or whatever, or I didn't care for this or.
So people, y'all could go to One and a Third Podcast Facebook page and either send messages or comment on things that we could do better, that you love, that you hate. And we would absolutely greatly appreciate the constructive criticism. If you're a dick, I'll delete it though.
Yeah.
I'll dive into what Zach was saying. With two different things. Number one, I couldn't agree more. I think it's the most rarest of things in the world is to have people speak their truth. Society has completely destroyed that because social media, if you speak your truth, then you get 700 people that say fuck you because they feel like they can. All that said, I think there's two words that I have learned over the last 5 or 6 years that have been the biggest game changers of them all. Zach, you and I have had the discussion many times about wisdom. I wish so badly people could teach wisdom. And you get these older, ornery people, get off my lawn type of guys that they are that guy. they are the guy that will say anything that they're feeling at any moment, right? I believe, as much as I've studied this in the last 5 years, I believe so much of that just simply comes from the awareness of mortality. I think that you hit a wall in your life, whether it's a traumatic event that occurred, like Tyler, obviously, whether it's you got sick and you started to, for the first time, have to think about a will or death or healthcare, things like that, or whether it's just a number of age that made you, you know, I turned 50 and mortality really hit me for the first time ever. And most of it had to do with my 7-year-old daughter that breaks my balls every day that I'm old. And it was like, it makes me sit back and think, I want to be here for when she's walking down the aisle. I want to be. And when you start to think about all those things, you really treasure every last millisecond. And so the bullshit no longer matters. Yeah. It's like, you know how, like, when you're 22, somebody texts you and goes, hey, we're all hitting up blah, blah, blah tonight on Friday night to go see this band. Do you want to come out? And you already know when you got the text, you have no interest in doing it. You don't want to do it. You have no interest. But let me check on this and let me see this and let me blah, blah, blah. And then a week later when it's time, you're like, you know, I thought about it. And like now I'm like, nope, I'm good. Thank you so much for the offer.
Yeah.
I appreciate you thinking of me, but no, thank you.
Yeah, or even coming up with some kind of bullshit excuse, you know, making, oh, no, the Thursday I've got a, you know what I mean?
No, that's what I'm saying. I don't want to, I don't have time for it anymore. I don't want to.
No.
And it's like you get to a point where you're like, I don't want to waste a single second on the bullshit, on the answers, on going there. I just want to be honest. But I also want to be accepted for being honest. I'm not going to be a dick about it. I'm going to have bedside manner. Thank you so much for the invite. But that's it. And you know, I wish so badly people could get around that at a much younger age.
Yeah, we've talked about that so many times, man, about how our bond and our relationship is so strong because of it, and how much different the world would be it's the vast, vast majority of people who bullshit. It just is. I mean, odds are whoever's listening to this right now does that in their life. And I'm not trying to be shitty to a person, but I'm saying, like, I don't think people realize how much trouble they would save themselves, like, just by being honest to people, and how much trouble they would save the other person.
Mm-hmm. Well, it comes down to, I've said it before and I'll say it again, that lying is a young man's game. I had a rifle penetrate my forehead one time. I ain't trying to remember what I told who. Like, and being caught in a lie or saying the wrong thing to the wrong person because you said something else last time is embarrassing as fuck. Like, why the fuck bother? Like, well, I respect you enough to just tell you exactly how I feel about it. And I honestly, I've never thought about it like that, Joe, but that is probably where it all came from. Because I came face to face with my mortality when I was 20 years old. Yep. So in a way, I'm very fortunate. I learned that I ain't wasting time with this bullshit, like, when I was technically not even all the way out of puberty yet.
Well, the crazy thing is that we all should be aware of our mortality.
Happier man for it.
We're all gonna die. Like, that's one certain thing. We don't know what happens when we die. We don't know a lot of things, but we know we're gonna die. And you don't know when it's gonna be. We all feel comfortable in our daily lives because you wake up, you do these things, you've done this thing before. But in reality, no one knows when it's going to happen. It could happen to all of us today. And that fact alone should make people stop with the bullshit. But I think, number one, they see it in everyone else in society, so they see it just as an acceptable behavior. It's what everybody else does. It's the easy way out often. Because there's times when I have to be honest that I don't enjoy it. But I know that it's the right thing. And in the end, it's going to make the most real result.
And I'm not talking being obnoxious either. Like, if someone's doing something wrong or says something wrong, it's just like, hey, man, you know, this, and this and that. Like, you don't got to be like, hey, you dumbass, in front of everybody.
Exactly.
Like, that's, I hope people don't think that when we say we are this, they don't think we're that. Where one of y'all would be on stage and just be like, hey, dumbass. Like, quit doing that because that's wrong. Like, calling someone out, like, that's another military thing. You praise in public and you correct in private. Like, because whoever it is about to be embarrassed on top of trying to figure out what it is they did wrong. And the embarrassment's going to take the front seat for sure. So, and then which resentment and whatever else, and they'll never get to the fixing it part because you're a dick.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to have those conversations with people. Mm-hmm. And I get that, but I also think, like I said, like, you know, in every part of your life, whether you're trying to make friends or make a relationship or whatever, you know, I've even preached to my kids forever about just stop trying to win. You know, you find somebody you're interested in, say a girl or a guy or whatever, and you put on this face and you pretend to be a person in order to win. And then you win and you've got to do one of two things, either keep up the lie, keep up the fake persona of this perfect person you've painted, or they're going to figure out that who you really are and not be interested. And that's why relationships fall apart. It's just become such a norm in society for people to treat everything like that. And it serves no purpose except to make it easier on you in that exact moment.
Well, and I was going to say, we've said that on a few different episodes now, and he got into it as well, where I want you to run early if I'm going to scare you off. Like, yeah. I want to tell you everything. I'm not giving you a highlight reel version of Tyler. You're getting the base model Ty and what he's about. And if you don't like it, this is your chance to get off the train. Like, and I'm going to be me the whole time, because exactly that, a lot of people, man, I want to see the percentage on that. The people who show a highlight reel, the whole dating phase, yep. Get the girl, get the guy, get married. And then you either have to just go back to being the normal you and then tell them to deal with it because you're married now, or yeah. Freaking put on this stressful persona all the time.
Yeah, it's a horrific thing to do to another person, really.
Why wouldn't you want someone to like you for the real you?
I think that goes back to what I said earlier when I said mortality and wisdom. I think we all eventually get it. There's not, including the three of us and probably everybody listening, we've all gone through a phase in our life where we wanted everybody to love us. We wanted everybody that we met to be our friend. And you hit a wall at a certain point in your life. You're like, you know what? If I have three people that I know that I can count on for fucking anything, I don't need four. I don't need five. And I'm not looking for all. But again, I don't think in the society that we live in, I don't think there's any way of learning that until you go through it and the wisdom to gain it. You get to this point in your life where all of these things that used to be really important are no longer important. I get asked often when I do podcasts or interviews, I get asked often as a writer, as a songwriter, my favorite lyric. And I say this all the time. My favorite thing I've ever written is not a lyric. It's something that I'll eventually use in my book, but I'm paraphrasing right now, but it's, if you wait until the traumatic event occurs in your life in order for you to make the changes that you've wanted to start making, if you wait until that moment, chances are you waited too long. And that's something that every single human being that I've spoken to who doesn't get that second chance. How many people we could probably list 100 between the three of us right now of somebody that had a health issue and therefore changed their entire eating ways or their smoking ways or their drinking ways. They wait until the disaster.
There's a problem. There's no proactive anything.
And it's the same thing with this, with mental. It's the same thing with something has to click within us before we can start just preaching truth and stopping the bullshit. And that's everybody. That's all three of us. And it's everybody else listening. Something has to occur for you to go, I don't have time for that anymore.
Yeah. You have to have a panic attack in the boardroom. And then now everyone thinks you're ready for a straitjacket and you're just like, holy crap. Maybe I should have just been me the whole time. And then I wouldn't have had to worry about everything else. I would have just had to perform.
Well, it's definitely something you can make a conscious choice if you're aware of it. Like, you don't have to go to get to that point. But you know, just going back to what you were just saying, Bogman, I eat like shit. I don't exercise. and it's going to take something terrible for me to do it. And I don't want that. Like, why can't I just change that today? Why can't I just, it's not easy. It's easy to look at something and understand something. It's much harder to put it into practice.
I was going to say, even two people that are very close to you had something that happened, and then they had to change their entire intake of life in general to fix their shape and their health and all their stuff, and yeah, still nothing.
Yeah, it's difficult. It's very hard. And I'd say it'd be the same to imagine, someone listening to this who has been kind of putting on a performance every day of their life to wake up tomorrow or today and go, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm just going to be straight with people all the time. But man, not is it today. Fucking freeing. It is a freedom that if you could live it for a while, you would never go back.
Mm-hmm. I lost my filter in the blast. There's actually a funny story from when I was still very much on a lot of different drugs, which is the only reason why it didn't get me in a modicum of trouble. I was the commandant of the Marine Corps. The commandant of the Marine Corps. That's the president of the whole Marine Corps, highest ranking dude in the entire thing, showed up to give me my Purple Heart, to present me with that. And I was still on all the drugs. And early on, my eyes didn't work quite right. I equate it to like a camera where you have to play with the lens. So if I'm focusing on my mom, who's right here, I can't see the door so hot. It takes me a second to like do the thing. So she comes up and is like, hey, the commandant of the Marine Corps is here. He'd like to talk to you. And I leaned in and said, tell him to go fuck himself. And she went pasty white. And I was like, what does that mean? He's directly behind her. He's in the room. And it was a man who was in the December of his tour. It's a 4-year tour as the commandant. He was almost done. So he knew we were on all of the drugs in the world. So he didn't penalize me for it, really. He just kind of drew circles in the sand and left. And a colonel of the liaison staff ended up giving me my Purple Heart a week later. And a month later, I got a private tour of the commandant's house. My unit got word that I said that to the commandant faster than they got word that I survived the blast.
Wow.
So just to shift gears a little, because we've only got so much time. No, you're good, man. We obviously talked about in the first episode, Tyler's experience, his traumatic day and thereafter. Bachman, I never really went all that deep with you about this, but you were actually in the Vegas shooting or at the location during all that, right? I believe I talked to you that day.
Did you?
I feel like I did. I feel like we texted each other that day randomly because we didn't talk all that much back then. But I vaguely remember you posted something and I texted you. I don't remember the details, but so I know you were not actually in the venue, right? You were outside of the venue near the hotel or something.
I was initially in the hotel and then ironically pushed outside because they thought the shooters were shooting indoors.
Wow. So they're like, hey, go out into the hail of machine gun fire.
That's exactly what happened. No lie. Yeah, I'll dial back 1 second because that's obviously why we're doing this podcast together.
Yeah.
2017 was 99% of the reason why I am traumatized, why I do suffer from as much mental health issues as I do. Full disclaimer, this is the first time I'm saying this publicly. Zach, you've gone through it. I don't know if you've discussed this yet, but I'm getting the SGB shot to try to pull these things down a little bit that I'm dealing with. And for your listeners, that's another topic altogether, but the SGB shot in short, is resetting your fight or flight by injecting a shot, into your neck. And in both mine and Zach's case, both sides, right and left.
For the uninitiated, there's no medicine. They actually just freeze the nerve cluster in your neck. So they're not injecting any kind of thing into you.
Literally anesthesia they're using.
Exactly. So it just freezes the nerve cluster for about 8 hours. It
literally resets the fight or flight.
Right. Yep.
And so I'm bringing that up to say, it's the shot's been around for 100 years. They started using it up until 2013, it was used pretty much exclusively for postpartum women that were suffering from postpartum depression from that. I'm saying all that to say it really made me dig deep these last 3 years. 2017, the end of 2016, my friend of 40 years in 2018, he lost his battle with addiction, in his case, heroin. But my wife and I lost 3 different children, pregnancies. I was in the Vegas shootings that you just discussed. My manager at the time of, I don't know how many years, 16 or whatever, he had a heart attack. He ended up taking close to $60,000 from me. The list goes on and on. The entire year for me was unbelievably traumatic. It was one month after another after another. And I'm one of those people that doesn't go to Vegas to party. I go to Vegas to chill. I go there. I typically will never leave the one casino, which is Mandalay Bay. And I'll go there and I will get a room, go down and have a massage, maybe play some cards, have some dinner, and then see a show and never leave the casino. And 3 days of that, and I feel like I'm completely reset and recharged. So 2017 was just week after week after week. It was one life-changing traumatic event after another, and I finally had enough in September, and I said to my wife, I need to reset. I need to go to Vegas, and I need to just reset my brain because this has been the worst year of my life. And I landed, and ironically, had no idea whatsoever that the concert was going on. I had no clue, even being in the country world, had no idea that Aldean and those boys were out there or that the festival was going on. And I got a text from Rich because Rich is the drummer for Aldean. And I had posted something about being in Vegas, and Rich asked if I was coming to the show. And I said, honestly, dude, I'm out here to avoid anything that has to do with crowds. Yeah. So no, but I'd love to meet up afterwards for dinner. And so I was sitting at a blackjack table and 6 armed men with machine guns in bulletproof vests ran by screaming, active shooter, get outside now. And so it was pandemonium and just hundreds of people running in every possible direction, pushing us outside. And as we're going outside, now it's the first time I'm hearing bullets. I'm hearing what sounded like automatic weapons. And so luckily for me, I was standing next to a Mandalay Bay security guard I followed him. He grabbed me and we ended up hiding under a car for 3 hours and listening. The bullets only lasted 15 minutes ish, but again, another podcast, but I'm sitting there listening to this guy's headset saying there's an active shooter in the Bellagio. There's an active shooter on Las Vegas Boulevard. There's an active. So I thought it was Taliban. I thought we were under, terrorist attack, and I thought we were all going down.
Red Dawn.
It's because of everything, the way our brains work these days, when you hear active shooter, having no idea. I mean, at the end of the day, ended up being the biggest mass killing in the history of the United States. So it was a big deal, but it all happened in 15 minutes. I came home 3 days or 2 days earlier than I was supposed to. My wife and I had what I like to call, I'm glad you're not dead sex, and got pregnant and lost another child.
Jesus.
3 months later, in December of that year. And 4 weeks after that, in January of 18, I woke up one day and told my wife I had a stomach ache like I've never had before. We all eaten the same thing. I was like, man, I feel like I got food poisoning like I've never had. And it turned into pancreatitis, which led me to 3 weeks in the hospital. 2 different nights they told my wife I wasn't going to make it through the night. And it ended up 3 months of being completely bedridden at home. That was my trauma. That whole year and everything that I just discussed is what changed me to a much more extreme dealing with mental issues. The sensory overload is what really, really, really changed more than anything else. So to anyone listening that has always broken my balls or Zach's balls or anybody else about, you get done your show at 9:01, you're out the door. What I live with every day, I call tics. I don't know if that makes any sense. That's just the word I use. But anything, if you hear somebody chewing loudly, if there's a TV on in a room that shouldn't be on, if there's two different music playing at the same time, if somebody's putting away silverware, if there's a click in a ceiling fan, every one of those things for me is a tick. And I only have a certain percentage of them before I go completely mental and I lose myself in a very angry way. And the only way that I can reset my ticks is solitude. There's no other way whatsoever. I've gotten and learned the ability to bring those down with both meditation and ambient music, specifically Brian Ficino's ambient music, and solitude. And as I've explained to my wife now of 13 years, I know it, and I know when it gets to that 90% or above range, and I know that I need to bow out. And she'll know too. She can see it in my eyes. But those are the things that I deal with on a daily. And so when I was at this For the Love of a Veteran dinner a couple of weeks ago and listened specifically to Dr. Mulvaney, who does these SGV shots, he's written 13 peer-reviewed studies in the last 13 years since he's been doing this. And his most recent peer-reviewed study is specifically dealing with how much the SGB shot has helped people specifically dealing with anxiety. So that's the reason I'm getting it. I don't suffer from depression at all. I don't believe my PTSD is anything like Tyler's PTSD. Tyler's is very specific from one event and mine is not, because I don't think any one of those events would have had the reaction that I'm having because of all of them.
Yeah.
No, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, mine comes from a specific category of thing. And yours ends up being if too many categories are open in the browser at the same time. Tracking.
I feel like it's similar for me. I feel like I'm in the same boat as you, Joe, where I couldn't really put it to one thing, but it's been a series of things. The SGB shot, it's strange that with the 13 peer-reviewed studies and all the information we know about it, how effective it is for anxiety and things like that, it just reinforces my thought that, you know, if it's not something that can put you on a drug that's regularly going to take money out of your pocket, it'll never be the front and center. You know what I mean? Because no one in the healthcare industry is trying to fix people. They're just trying to, you know, bleed people out of their money, essentially.
I was going to say, no one wants to cure cancer or cure PTSD because that'll put all the drugs that treat them out of business. That'll put therapists out of, you know, the list of people who will lose money off that is too much.
Yeah.
But here's the irony behind that. I use diabetes as an example because it runs in my family. Mm-hmm. But in 2018, when I got the pancreatitis and I was diagnosed with diabetes, I immediately, because of what I said, I immediately used that and said, I'm going to change the way that I eat forever. And they put me on, I was taking 11 different doses of insulin per day, some in shot form, some in pill form. And after 60 days, I went and saw my diabetes doctor. And as any new patient has to do, that we have to keep track of our blood sugar like six different times a day, every day of the week. And you bring it to them in 90 day batches. And he looked at me and I have all my numbers way, 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 way below what they should be in a good way.
Yeah.
And he goes, I got to take you off this medication. You don't need it. He said, you've reversed the diabetes. And I looked him right in the face and I said, I have to ask you, never once did you ask me about my diet. Never once did you tell me to change what I was eating. All you did was said, if your blood sugar raises to this, it's this much insulin. If it comes down to this, blah, blah, blah. And I said, I reversed it 100% because of diet. Why don't you tell people that? He looked me right in the face and he said, every day that these people walk in the door, my patients, all they want to know is, how many shots of insulin do I need if I want to eat that Snickers bar tonight? That's all they care about. They're not interested in getting better. They're interested in living their lives. And so it comes down to what Zach just said. They're creating customers. They're not trying to heal anybody. And it's certainly the same. This SGB thing, we're literally talking about resetting a nerve, right? We're not talking about creating anybody that's going to come back for that new medication.
Yeah. It's been described to me as a cure for PTSD. Like, because, I mean, we talked about it too, the Lance. I didn't know Lance from Adam. He was just some quiet dude that was at events. Mm-hmm. His dog put his silly cold nose on my nubs, and I didn't like it. and then he had a very attractive wife with colorful hair, and that was the extent of it. And then he got the shot, and now he's one of my closest friends. Like he fully out of the shell is a whole different dude.
You're talking about Lance Price from. Also from SFH. I just wanted to be clear for people that
one of the other co-owners and yes. But
we collectively, the three of us collectively, have many more that have been very, very affected by. I mean, I can say it out loud. He gave me permission. But Ryan, Ryan had the shot this past summer, and he's just a different person. Right? Ryan Trent and Sean Spencer.
I was going to say because I heard Sean got it as well. I was going to say because his roommate's name's Ryan, and I got that mixed up more than once now.
Oh, God. So. Yeah. There's Droll. There's your friend of 20-something years. There's Trent. Sean Doc Spencer.
McAbee.
Yeah, he got it for his mother after he got his own. And he will yell from the mountaintops that this shot has completely changed him and his mom's life. Mm-hmm. So,
it does not work for everyone.
No, I know it didn't work for you. And to be fair to you, and you've said this, it may have worked for you, but only on the very, very bottom basement level, right? Which is what you and I talked about.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the other thing, too. The reason that I know about this entire organization and this shot is a veteran named Chad Reynolds. I'm just a huge fan of Chad. Him and I met 11 or 12 years ago when I was playing in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. We became friends ever since. And he told Christine Waltz and Mike Waltz, he told them about my songs for the troops. And that's how we connected. So I say all that to say, I've tried to be a student of this SGB shot because I have so many people in my life that have gone through it. But Chad said to me point blank up until 6 months ago, he was like, I got it. Didn't work for me, but I'm the biggest advocate for it. Because I've watched how many lives it's changed.
Yeah.
However, I just saw Chad 3 weeks ago. He went and got it for the second time. And he said this changed everything for him. And he said the biggest thing that he did this time, based on what the doctor told him, was after you get the shot, they advise you to sleep. And he said both days he did not sleep when he got the shots before. And the shot did nothing for him. This time he forced himself to sleep. And he said it was night and day. Take that for what it's worth, but I had never heard anybody say that before.
Yeah, I don't recall if I slept because I had it in both sides. I don't recall if I took the doctor's orders and actually followed through with that.
Sure. I'm gonna put my remaining limb on. No, you didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't remember going out of my way to do so, and my sleep is just because of depression, absolutely fucked. And
I was gonna say, I know you sleep horribly. Yeah,
it's the small chunks, and they could be in the afternoon, it could be in the evening, it could be I don't know when, and it's horrific.
Just whenever it strikes you.
You know, the funny thing is talking about your doctor not going with trying to fix what you're eating and fix your life instead of just taking medicine. You could really kind of put that across the board for almost anything. I mean, people that get on SSRIs to solve depression instead of fixing the things in their life that are causing them problems, which, you know, I still, you know, obviously these last few days have been rough. Like I've had the last week has been really dark for me and just not in a good headspace. So I'm not saying that it's always a good thing that I didn't ever take SSRIs or that I don't take SSRIs, but I just feel like that would have been putting a Band-Aid on a gaping wound. You know, like I just don't feel like that it was useful. I do feel like that the more I've learned about those in particular, that sometimes it can kick people off if they get the idea that you know, they're going to go on it and then get off of it soon, that sometimes it can kind of give them a kickstart to solving the things that'll help with their depression. But you could go down the line with medications people take to resolve things instead of fixing what's causing it. Like, we're treating symptoms and not the problems, you know?
Which is true of most problems in today's everything, society or otherwise. You want to bark at whoever and have a problem with that guy, as opposed to figuring out why it's a freaking problem in the first place and just squaring it away.
Right.
Everyone's going straight to the step that won't actually help the situation.
Yeah. It's crazy.
I mean, for me, anytime you want to get me on a podcast and talk smack on Big Pharma, I'm in. But that's a whole different topic.
Punch him in the throat.
Yeah, I think we're working on that podcast, aren't we, Bachman?
Yeah, I'm all about that.
Yeah.
Shit. The minute I could get off of everything that they put me on, I did. Withdrawals suck. But I wasn't going to be dependent. I was telling him on the episode, I was only going to get one tattoo. The moment I stay hooked on methadone is when I wouldn't be around as long as y'all met me. Like, y'all never would have known me if I didn't choose to get off it whenever they told me I could. Cause that was in the beginning of all my therapies and stuff. That was not 2.5 years later.
I know we talked about it before, but a lot of times people that go on pain medications and stuff, that's how they end up heroin addicts. I mean, it is the starting story for so many addicts, where they were on prescription drugs because of an injury, because of something that happened, and it just led to them, you know, having to find it somewhere else because they couldn't get the prescription.
Sucking dick for drugs.
Which, again, this could go to a whole other podcast. Well, your internet's not rocking today, Ty.
Mine?
Yeah, I lost your video altogether over here. But it'll be fine in post. Like, everyone will see it fine because you're still uploading at 99%. It's a cool thing about this software, Bachman, is that you're recording it on your phone separately from what we're seeing on the screen. So just your feed will be uploaded at the end of the episode.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, phone. It won't fuck up your phone or bog you down. It'll go to him.
Right. Oh, that's awesome. I love that. Yeah.
So same with Ty right now. I have no video for him. I don't know if you do.
I do not.
He's completely gone, but in post it'll be fine.
I just did a big old middle finger to Bocho.
I thought you were going to say you just stripped down or something. I'm naked.
Well, no, you just said that they're going to see it, so I can't be like, well, here we go. Everyone's going streaking through the quad.
There you are. You're back again.
Hey, Macarena.
Anyways. We've looked forward to this for quite some time. Like, I know we did those little mini podcasts during the pandemic, talking about the pandemic. That was a lot of fun.
We had
Oz and
Steve Turner.
Steve Turner came on one time. It was a good time.
Kyle Campbell. Yeah, it was great.
That's right.
I miss Oz. I miss Oz a lot. If you're listening, bro, I miss
Oz
you, dude.
Kicking with Barstool Sports, man.
Oh no! I'm excited. I follow him on everything still, so I'm excited for your success, brother. I just want to try to link up at some point, see you again.
Anybody ever gets to Nashville, Chris Ferrara and the Common Good every single Friday and Saturday at Barstool Sports, killing it, just absolutely killing it.
Well, it's Oz,
right?
He's amazing. Quick story. Sorry, before you get into what you were gonna say, sorry, Oz. When they were in St. Augustine visiting, and we went out to Irish pub that I like to drink at, and there was this dude doing his thing, the paid musician, who in my opinion wasn't super stellar great, but he was taking a break, and I was like, hey, my buddy's a singer, would you mind if he got up there and did one for me? And he was like, yeah, when I'm on break, go for it. And Oz got up there and tore the roof off the place.
Indeed.
The manager and a few other people were like, bro, we need him here every weekend. And I was like, he's a professional. He's doing it already in bigger joints. And I almost felt bad because the subpar gentleman had to get back up there and do the rest of his set after Oz just showed them what it's supposed to be.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. Carry on.
So I think some people would be disappointed if we didn't talk about music a little bit, but the part that I want to talk about, just because it's been an interesting feeling this last year, and I think we're both kind of going through it at the same time, where I don't want to say we lost our passion for it. I think that we both feel like, I've always felt like, if we ever got to the point where it started to feel like a job versus something we love, that we would shift gears, which is kind of what we've done. Instead of doing the residencies, we're playing several days a week, at least for now. You know, I don't know what the future holds as far as what we're doing. Just, you know, where you're at mentally with that, like, can you expand on that a little bit for how you feel and you know, what we've been through and where you're at right now?
Yeah, I'm at the most unique point in my life, and 99% of it is because of these mental health struggles. As you know, but I'll say it real quick for any of the listeners, I have a company that I run with Ryan Tren called Vacation Jams, where we put on festivals that, obviously, Zach, you work with us as well. And that has taken on a life of its own. And then I have another company where we manage other artists. And so playing music, like you said, the one thing that Zach and I have always shared in common, no, there's never going to be a point in time where I hear Sweet Caroline come on the radio in my car and I leave it on. It's never going to happen. Just right. Can't wait to get it off. But for the 3 minutes that I'm on stage with Zach and that song begins and every single room is screaming, I love the song as much as anything I've ever heard for those 3 minutes.
It's hours at that point.
Right, exactly. And so do I still have the same love and passion for performing in front of an audience with you? 100%. I still have that. Everything that comes along with it has beaten me down to a place that I haven't been beaten down this low before.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore I needed to step back, because walking into venues, walking into private events, dealing with either management I didn't like, sound people I didn't like, drunken guests I didn't like, and then the sensory issues that I continuously have gotten worse, all of those things have triggered me to say, if you don't focus on you, you're not going to ever get that back. And right. That's where I'm at right now. So I have some medical stuff that I'm doing for myself right now, that I'm procedures and things that I've put off for years that I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And also the mental stuff and the shot. And I think I texted you this the other night. I hope I did, because I said to my wife 2 nights ago, I said, I just told this to Zach. I am at a low point with respect to, you know, I don't have a residency right now. There's a lot of things that have not gone our way in the last 15 to 18 months with music and the places that we were supposed to play.
Yeah.
So all those things brought me down to here. But since I came home from Mexico and I'm prioritizing my own mental health above everything else for the first time ever, I'm sad, but I feel like I'm healing.
Yeah.
And that's the first time I've ever been able to say that, because to go back when I was talking to you guys about the tics, if I go through 4 days of shows, that's thousands of tics. So my 3 days off are just about getting them low enough to be able to go back and do it again.
Mm.
And I can tell you that the tics don't go down. If I'm alone and I have ambient music and I have my headphones, I can get from 95% down to almost zero in 24 hours. But if I come home and I have a 2-year-old toddler, that's a literally tornado around the clock. My daughter wants to consume my time. My wife and I want to catch up. So now, instead of going from 95 to zero in 24 hours, I go from 95 to 85. Because I still have tics going on all the time. So yeah. I've never been at this point in my life where I'm not going out. I'm not doing the things that I've ever done other than staying home, taking on the family, devoting a lot of time to cleaning up my mental and physical health and trying to reset all of this. And where that leads me, like you just said, I don't know. I don't know right. if this is in 6 months from now, is it going to get to a point where I can't wait to have another residency with you? You know, that's fair. That's all possible. But at least right now we're in a great spot where we can say, you have the podcast, we're both managing other people, and let's at least at the bare minimum, let's talk about doing private events and things like that. We still get to see each other. We still get to play.
Right.
But as far as going back to a 4 day a week thing, I don't know. I don't know if it's ever going to happen, if it's ever something that I can mentally do again. But I know that you and I, at the end of September of this year, we felt very, very mentally exhausted from that summer.
And kind of done. I mean,
yeah,
not done, but done, you know?
Right.
Because I think something that you and I have also shared that makes us so great at what we do is the passion that we have on the stage. Like you say it as believable passion, but I never felt like we had to put on believable passion. We both just felt that. And, you know, that being said, like I don't want to, I know you're with me. I don't want to cut people short by going on stages and phoning it in. I would never be that. Mm-mm.
So before we move on to the next thing, one, I'm super elated and proud of you for, one, getting the medical things done that you've been putting off for however long. That's fucking awesome. Two, taking the time to do the mental side of it is awesome, because I feared that you were going to say that without the residency or without this or without that, you were unmoored and just adrift. Without having that. And I'm excited that that's not the case, that you've pulled into a different port and you're working at it from every angle possible to make sure it remains a positive and thriving force in your life. And as someone who cares about you, I'm elated to hear that. So thank you for sharing all of that.
Well, it ironically leads me to what I would hope your guests would get out of this podcast. If they get anything out of it from me, there are two sides of Joe Bachman that have been terrified of this conversation. Side one is the military child. I'm supposed to be the tough guy for my family, and I'm not supposed to talk about this, and I'm not supposed to deal with it. Side two is the artist, the avatar, the fake. You always hear celebrities, not that I'm a celebrity, I don't mean it that way at all, but somebody that's in a public eye, even in a small way, you always hear these people discuss the horrible divorce they went through, or the drugs that they went through, or the mental health issues. You hear it 20 years later. You hear it because they couldn't talk about it when they were trying to sell shows and CDs. And that has been, for me, one of the most challenging things I've ever gone through. I would read Zach Polk's posts 4 years ago, 6 years ago, 7 years ago on Facebook, and the military guy in me would go, Jesus Christ, dude, keep that shit to yourself. Like, I know you're depressed, but like, you don't need to put that out there. And then Zach moves in with me and we're around each other 24/7. And I've said for the last 4 years, I've learned more from Zach in the last 4 years than I've ever learned from anybody. But learning about, number one, the only way we're going to get other people to talk about it is if we do.
Yeah.
And that goes for my business. My business is entertainment. I do it. I sing it. I manage it. I build, like, everything I do is entertainment. And nobody in our business is talking about this shit since Jelly Roll.
And Jelly Roll.
God, that dude has opened up a world. I said to Ryan Trent the other day, Ryan Trent's just one of the biggest Jelly Roll fans in the world. I don't really get his music. And I'm not saying that in a mean way. The dude writes dark. The dude writes really, really, really dark shit that I can't connect with because I've never been there.
Mm-mm.
He's opened up a whole – no, you're fine to go. But that's what I was saying, is thank God that people are finally getting the courage because of guys like him to come out and go – you need to fucking talk about it, whatever you're dealing with.
To actually use the platform.
Good. Yeah.
Yes.
To actually use their platform, even if it's a low level celebrity status like you and I share, where it's like we have a handful of people. But you also don't realize when you're thinking about being an entertainer from the outside, you don't think about how you eventually become connected to these people in their lives. And you realize how much shit other people are going through. And then it's like, okay, well, I want you to know what I'm going through because I'm hoping that I can help you with what you're going through by putting all that shit on social media and reaching out to people and letting them know that I'm human and I'm fucked up. You know, my daughter said it best. We were sitting in Orlando and we were talking about, I think I might've said this on another podcast. I don't remember, but, we were talking about how these people, you know, and I love this part of it, but it can be a lot sometimes where there's people who just want a piece of you because you're an entertainer, because you're this thing, and they want more than you've got to give. And I was talking about some of those like extra fans, like huge fans, and AD just stops and she goes, you know, that's pretty cool and all, but have they seen your room? I was like, that is so profound and hilarious.
She can appreciate the best of them.
Yeah.
Oh, 80.
Wild.
Well, no, you're fine, dude. And I think the thing is people, they look at Joe Bachman, the entertainer, Zach Polk, I hate Zach Polk. They look at those things as avatars. They look at those things as a created, you know, Garth Brooks, when he refers to himself as Garth Brooks, and he talks in the third person because to him, that's not the man. That's the entertainer. And that makes so much more sense to me than it ever has before, because if you think about it, these people create this perfect image, perfect looks, perfect voice, auto tune. The list goes on and on and on and on. People are finally starting to understand that there's nothing real about that. And when you come home and you bring the way that you're hurting, the fact that you just said on this live podcast, the fact that you said this last 4 days, I've been in a really, really dark place. People hear that and instantaneously go, he's not trying to be anything fake. Mm-mm. That, even if they don't connect with the depression, they connect with somebody that's feels comfortable enough in their own skin to go, I'm not trying to be anything I'm not right now, but I'm having a really fucking hard time. And it took me 48 years to get there.
Mm-hmm. I don't, and I also want to make a point to say that it's not for sympathy. It's for people to understand that life is so imperfect. And I know other people go through this shit. When you have a society that is uncomfortable talking about it, then they just sit with it and they think they're alone in that. And not being alone in that has, whether it's through music or what the avenue is, has really helped me to know other people feel it. I don't want someone to fix me, but knowing someone else knows what it feels like and I'm not alone has meant so much to my healing, even if it's temporary. Ty, so I think you said you had a question.
No, so before I ask Joe that one, I would like to point out that neither me or Joe, two people who absolutely love and care about you, when you said that, neither of us were, oh my God, what can we do? Can you tell us what we can do? How do we help? How do we do
right.
Because we know, if you have something that we could do, you'd tell us about it or ask us or approach us about it. So, because literally just getting it off your chest is a huge one. And then knowing that people heard you, listened, boom. Like that ends up being 60 to 80% of the whole freaking problem anyways, just because everyone has to bottle it up and be Irish about it and just bury it under the drinks.
It's also, and I've said this and I'm going to say this every podcast till the end, but so much about doing this and taking the time and all the effort that I've put in and the hours of learning and editing and every single thing I do is 100% for the one person that finds some solace in this. Like this is not, I don't want attention for it. I don't give a shit. Like, I don't care if we have 100 listeners forever. If those 100 listeners feel something and get something from it. I truly do this for my own healing because that makes me feel like my life is and my pain and my struggle is worthwhile to share that.
I was going to say, yeah, if one person heard the message and, you know, wakes up or feels seen, feels that, you know, oh wait, someone does get it. maybe I can do X, Y, and Z in a manner, you know, whatever. Just if someone feels that someone gets it, then bam, yeah. Success. I don't care if we blow up, if we're ever Joe Rogan. Yep. You know, I just literally, I will count victories like that until the end.
Yeah.
One thing Zach has taught me, well, he's taught me hundreds of things, but one of the most profound things he taught me is one of the first things he taught me, which is people who suffer from depression, sometimes all they need is in a year. That's it. Just if they know that I'm there, Zach's not looking for me to fix something he know I can't fix. But if I'm going to be there each and every time he wants to talk, that in itself is enough solace and love for him to move on until tomorrow.
Yep. Knowing you have someone standing there for the trust fall.
Yep.
Which is an important point because huge. I feel like there's a number of people who get really uncomfortable when someone leans on them in that way, when they're in such a dark place, because they don't have an answer, but you don't need an answer. And the thing about it is that I am more educated on depression and have sat with and overthought every aspect of this than anyone who doesn't deal with it. So it's like, what answers could you give me that I haven't already processed 1,000 times in my head? So it's just knowing someone cares and they're there with you through it, where you're not alone, because loneliness is a massive part of it, because you pull yourself away from everyone. You hermit up. Like even in the last few days, I've been noticing, like, I'm getting what's the word I'm looking for? Like public anxiety, like even driving up the street to the gas station or going to McDonald's or like, which is 3 blocks away, is like, I'm getting this anxiety from, it just kind of is perpetuated into this bigger thing. And having someone there through that moment, through that time, just to fucking care, just to give a shit, is so fucking important.
Sure.
Big wins.
I know we're getting close to the end, and I only have one question, but I want you to ask yours first, Tyler.
Mine's going to take longer to answer, so I please ask yours.
All right. Well, mine is for you. We've known each other over a decade now, and I knew you guys were delving into this thing. And myself and Zach, Brian Weiss, another owner of SFH, and I could list about 30 more people, have all said hundreds of times, you are the single most positive human being we've ever known. And we've used you as somebody that we look up to for that reason. Has there ever been a moment, and when I say ever, I mean, could have been the day after your accident, but has there ever been a moment or moments where you just fucking lose it and you're like, I can't believe this happened to me?
There was one time.
Just once.
So any other lulls or bouts or big low points in my life were not specifically woe is me, why this. It ended up being a lot of other factors. But on that that particular thing where, you know, why couldn't I have missed it, or why, you know, what I never thought, why could someone else have stepped on it? Because
no, of course.
That's no. And I'm making sure that it, cause if you put all 12 of us in a line, I'd have stepped on it on purpose if it was one of them who had to do it after. But, so July 4th of 2010, I was hit May 5th. So right. I was relatively fresh. I had a panic attack that morning on the way to surgery. My first ever panic attack. And the only reason I knew it was happening is because I seen the movies. And my mom, you know, held me close. I tried to get my breathing under control. I ended up, got the bile in the little thing she put in front of my face, had my surgery. And then when I woke up in recovery, they told me that I wouldn't be able to go outside and see the fireworks that were going to be on display. So on July 4th, I ultimately decided that independence was never going to be mine again. And wow. Then pretty much the following day, I washed my hand of that bullshit and got back to being me, and bumper cars in the hallways and fucking with nurses and doing everything I always did. That was a very long and shit. Oh, and I had, you know, those like movie dreams when you wake up and it takes you a minute to realize that, oh shit, this is the real life, not what was just happening. I woke up that same morning having had like a Sandlot football dream where I like got the touchdown or something, and you know, I was cheering or something when I woke up, and then I was just like, ah, fuck, you know. So I just started the day in like a this bullshit.
Okay.
Because back then I was still in a hospital bed and I wasn't mobile. They had to take the bed to OR. I wasn't even in a big chair yet. But yeah, once.
Wow. Amazing.
It's wild.
So what's your question, brother?
So mine's kind of, it's a three-parter, and I'm going to ask it to any other musicians we have as I ask Zach. What is your favorite song, your favorite artist or group? The song could also be album. And the Walk the Line question, if you had time to play one song before your end, what song would it be?
You can tell him he's a real asshole for asking these questions.
No, these are amazing. Number three, you're saying if I could play one more song live?
See, that was his distinction that I wasn't ready for. But hit live was one answer, and like To Your Loved Ones was another one.
Oh.
So yeah, if you had a stage and a crowd that was in the palm of your hand, that could be its own version.
For musicians, I would ask that.
Yeah, so yes, if you had a stage, if you were at the Wynn and opening for Garth, and the room was yours for the taking, what was, and then you were, your demise was directly after.
Wow.
Let's go with that.
So my favorite song has never changed in as many years as I can remember. My favorite song is The Dance by Garth Brooks. That just has so much meaning to me, and it's one just beautiful. A beautiful, beautiful song. The second question was favorite artist and or band, so I'm going to give you one of each.
Go. I'm cool with that.
Artist is Garth and band is the Eagles. Okay. Same thing. I just think – and then the last song, I have to give you two parts to this.
Go on.
As far as me playing. I have never had an emotion performing live the way that I do when I perform a Soldier's Memoir in front of our veterans.
It's a good one.
It's an emotion that I only get doing that, and I couldn't describe the emotion because the emotion is one of sadness, one of pride, one of the list goes on and on. But it's not one emotion. But when I do it and I look out into the crowd, it's pretty fucking intense. As far as performing, I would give anything in my world to do one full room and give me and Zach our 30-minute medley. Because there are moments that we've done that medley that I will never forget as long as I live. And I just know what it does to a room.
So well, that's not give, even. Yeah, go ahead.
No, it's just that feeling of overall a connection with an audience that you can't describe unless you've done it. And when you have it, it's like you just found a drug that never existed before. Yep. And it's so fucking cool.
Oh, yeah.
Because you feel at one with your duo partner, but you also feel at one with the audience.
Yeah, I was going to say, y'all become a homogenous unit.
It's
because
intense.
I've seen y'all do it more than once to very different crowds. And it doesn't not crush ever.
Mm-mm.
Obviously, it can hit harder sometimes. Your answers didn't surprise me. That's funny. In my head, I could have answered him for you. but as an audience member, when you play a Soldier's Memoir, it's a feeling in the audience too, for the record. So the fact that you can feel it from the stage is also spectacular as an audience member. That's cool.
I'd say your song.
I think you should
add
one more question when you ask musicians.
Ooh, hit me. I'm excited to learn.
You should ask every musician the best live show they've ever seen.
Ooh, what's the best live show you've ever seen, Joseph?
Mine's Boys to Men.
I could have answered all these questions.
And honestly, I don't think most people would, because I've seen Garth. I've seen every country artist that I've seen U2 20 times. I've seen Metallica 12. Those all blew me away. But Boyz II Men, 20 plus years later in Vegas, thinking I was walking into three guys singing to a track and watched a 14-piece band and Wanye singing those tunes in the same key as he did 20 years ago was like, blew me away. Yeah.
Wow. Hey, just before I go on, or before we go on from this, I'd say there's a pretty similar feeling. Well, I can't say that because you're the one singing it, but I can imagine it's probably a pretty similar feeling when you do The Way I Used to Be.
Oh God,
bro, that tears me apart. Sadness, like the emotion is just as real.
Yeah,
but there's no there's no hope on that song, right?
Yeah.
That song is about with PTSD song. There's hope, and so it's like I said, when I look out and I see pride and I see sadness and I see hope and I see so many, especially people that hear it for the first time that have served, it's like, but yes, from an emotional standpoint, from me, as far as myself, The Way I Used to Be is more emotional.
Yeah.
I get it.
So on that note, so, you know, someone whose grandfather, ended up meeting his demise with Alzheimer's, that song is hopeful is not the right word, but it helped me focus on the positive stuff and not the fact that when the last times I went to visit him, he didn't know me from Adam and that I was just some vet he was talking to.
Yep.
Cause he was a carpenter. I'll show you houses these hands built. I lose it, but I think about that. I'm like, I think about the good times with my grandfather only because of that song. And separately, I know we're running out of time, my bad. But when you played it, we talked about it on an episode here. When you played it in Mexico at Way Down Here 2, was the first time I heard you play it live.
Oh.
I was talking with somebody, and I heard it coming on, and I was like, shit the fuck up. I was like, is he about to do this shit live right now? Like, I thought you were going to break down. And that was definitely the first time I heard
Kenny
do the Kenny part. And how perfect for the end of that to have Kenny do the end. Oh, my God. But me and
I'll never forget the first time I was standing next to Zach and I played that for Zach when he heard Kenny's voice come in. Zach was like, dude, Kenny killed it. He really
when
killed
I told we were, him, we were, I good.
We were in the Jeep. We were in the Jeep driving downtown Orlando at like 2 a.m. during the pandemic trying to get out of the house.
Crying while driving.
And then I remember the first time I heard you play it, it was Father's Day. We were at some roast beef place in Philly or some shit.
Oh, Nick!
And I remember I'm sitting off to the side, just waterworks, dude, bawling my eyes out from the first note. And then I came up and we hugged, and somebody got a picture of that. Those times when you got that those hugs where you're like, I'll remember that hug, dude. That hug was just so meaningful at that exact moment. Well, we're getting close to time for you to split here, Bachman. So, is there anything you want to plug or talk about? Anything you got coming up?
I don't want to plug anything, man. I'm not in that headspace anymore. But I will say, I would like to say to the two of you that you're doing amazing things. I want to do anything in my power to help the message that you guys are bringing. You're bringing an awareness, but coming from two people that come from such completely opposite ends of the spectrum and having this discussion so freely and admitting we're not doctors, we're not trying to heal anybody. But you've not just become two voices, you've become four ears. And I think that's pretty incredible. I think that's going to be the biggest change right here is you're allowing people to have this conversation. Because even when Zach first reached out to me and said, hey, we want you to be one of our first guests, it's the first time I remember feeling nervous in probably 20 years because I don't get nervous on stage. I felt
this ain't
nervous.
That.
it's talking about a vulnerable spot of my life that I've never, ever, ever talked about openly.
Yeah.
But I promised myself I'd come on this thing. You asked me last night, right, Zach? You said, is there anything you don't want to say? And I said, no, like I wanted to be an open book. I wanted to talk about whatever I could, because if this allows, like you said, if this allows one other person, especially in our business, to go, all right, it's okay to feel this way. It's okay for me to understand. I guarantee you there's probably a couple dozen people in our industry that the sensory overload part will hit home for them. There's probably a lot more people affected by it than we realize.
Yeah. And it's not something that I was extremely familiar with before you. to be honest with you, man. Like, and I think some people aren't aware that it's that extreme for some people, that it's that intense. So it was a lot. It was a lot to learn, and I still think that a lot of people don't understand it.
No doubt.
Well, thank you for being on, dude. This has been amazing. Sure. I had a great time. I've been looking forward to it. I'm sure we'll have you back on again. Plus, you and I are talking about doing some kind of thing.
For sure.
Which would be much a whole different avenue. Something else that we both want to get off our chest, but not so much mental health based.
oh no.
Yeah, it'll be a good one. We'll have this up. Well, I mean, it'll be Tuesday when people are hearing it, but I'm going to put it out in a week. So we'll put some little stuff out on social meds.
Clippies.
Boy, Ty, your internet is freezing you in some weird ass places. I'm glad nobody's seeing this shit.
Do I need to do anything when we hang up? Like, I want to make sure I don't screw up your.
I don't think so. I think once we hang up, it'll tell you anything you need to do, but I don't think you need to do anything.
Once he officially stops recording, you can just hang up.
Yeah. All right, perfect. Pretty sure it does it all. It's uploading as we speak, so it should be completely uploaded by the end of it. But anyway, gentlemen, have a great rest of your week. And thankfully, we're all still fucking here.
Still fucking here.
Love you both, boys. See you later.
Love you,
brother.